You're listening to Frame 25, a brand new micro edition of the Brightwall Darkroom podcast in conversation with and sponsored by our friends at Gallery. Every month, we'll pick a title from Gallery's curated library and zoom in on a moment to better see the whole. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Chad, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I've been missing you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to talk about the movie today.
Can't wait. We'll catch up on the other pod.
Yeah, tune into the long episode to hear how we're doing.
Where we're humans, yes. Yeah, so this one you picked. Which one are we talking about today?
So today we're chatting about Todd Haynes' film Safe from 1995, recommended by Karen Kusama. I think it's really interesting to think about Kusama as a kind of Southern California obsessed filmmaker and how this film is such an interesting kind of like funhouse portrait of Southern California and of the Valley specifically, and of, I guess, Sherman Oaks specifically.
Yeah. I was reading a lot of Todd Haynes interviews this morning, and he did say like a lot of what you're just saying about the echoes of all that kind of stuff and how the new agey like camp is basically like an inverted valley and all that. It was fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of California all over this one. It captures California in a very interesting way.
That's really interesting. So even after we leave California in the film, we're still kind of in the valley somehow.
Yes.
In the desert.
Yes. And yes. And the values that it's poking fun at in, you know, a lot of that stuff is obviously stuff that a lot of people still associate with people that live in California.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Not a lot has changed since 1987/1995.
I guess not. I hope that's not true. I really love Kusama's films. And
I do,
think
too.
The first I saw was The Invitation.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll never forget the kind of shot that she has at the end of the film. I hope this isn't a spoiler for people, but like there's this great kind of shot. It doesn't really tell you much if you haven't seen it, but just of red lights kind of like confetti through the Hollywood Hills, I think it is. Like, it's just such a, based on the context of the film, such a scary kind of sense of space. And Destroyer too is just like, So great.
Yeah. And that's the Nicole Kidman one, right?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always forget that title always makes me, for some reason, not think of that movie. But then I always remember that it exists. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
I have not seen Yellow Jackets. Have you seen that one? I think she had a lot to do with that.
I haven't.
I haven't either.
I know it's like girls cannibal show.
Yeah. And people love it. And we love it. We love, like Spencer said last time, it is great that things exist for everybody. I just haven't seen this
100%. 100%. I'm too busy with my 18th rewatch of Girls to watch another girl cannibal show. So
I mean, you got to get at least to 100 on that. So
yeah, I'm busy.
Sorry, watching Girls. Yeah. Anyway, so Safe. It sounds weird to even ask the question of like, what do you like this movie? What did this movie do to you? And then let's get to the moment.
Yeah.
What does watching it do to you? Because I have a very specific reaction both times I've seen it in my life.
Oh, I'm excited to hear what that is. So I haven't seen the film probably, aside from this morning, since maybe 2008. Mm-hmm. And I came into it already really loving Todd Haynes and Julianne Moore's work together in Far From Heaven, which is 2002.
Oh, wow. Is that long ago?
I'm pretty sure. Ooh. Yeah.
No, I think that sounds right, but 21 years.
Yeah. And this is his second feature. It's their first collaboration, which is crazy to think about. Safe chronicles the kind of gradual disintegration of Sherman Oaks housewife Carol White, played by Julianne Moore. And this is their first kind of melodramatic collaboration together. I know that she stars in his latest work, May December. This is kind of long-standing relationship between the two of them. And in Safe, we get a lot of film citation, which I know is something you and I have talked about off mic before, or like, you know, slacked about off mic, that Safe is something that references Jean Dielman, the Chantal Ackerman film, Red Desert, the Antonioni film, and
2001. Yeah, he talks about that. Yeah,
totally. And is just giving this like, and I think this is where Kusama is maybe finding a point of resonance. It's giving this kind of 80s suburban quiet horror addition to a canon of films that are exploring kind of female malaise. And here with Safe, it's just such an indelible performance by Moore. I love everything that she's doing.
Unbelievable.
I feel like it's a movie about her respiration problems almost more than anything.
Which I can totally relate to. It's an it's an asthma movie.
It's an asthma movie. Asthma movie canon.
Yeah.
You know, she like has this funny, breathy, total head voice as opposed to chest uh-huh. voice that is so strange to listen to and yeah. such a like hallmark of the performance of the character. And then she's also having these sort of like asthma attacks, question mark.
Let's call them.
Yeah.
They are.
All of which is so strange to rewatch now in a kind of post, I'm doing air quotes around post, but post COVID mm-hmm. kind of world where yeah. things like masks and oxygen tanks and widespread anxiety about environmental illness are so like in the air, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's really bizarre to watch and have it be as sort of resonant with 2023 as much as it feels almost like science fiction
yeah.
in 1987, right?
Well, and famously, one of the major publications referred to it in the original review as taking place in the future.
Yes.
But like the very first thing right on the card is, you know, 1987. So,
right.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be yeah. the future.
No, it's so situated.
Yeah.
I mean, all the mise-en-scene, all of those, like, I mean, I'm obsessed with the way this movie looks.
Yeah, same. I just call it wide shots.
Yeah, it really is. It's crazy wide shots.
With a Z.
I love that. They're like the color palette.
So composed.
All the symmetry. I mean, you really get the kind of Jean Dielman of it all with these long takes.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And central kind of framings and these kind of sickly pastel and even neon colors that have this kind of like Miami, like bleached out cocaine decor.
80s. TM. Yes.
Yeah, it just looks so crazy.
And there's so many aerobics scenes.
There's only two, but it okay. does.
In my
feel
mind,
like
there's like
lot.
Eight. Yeah. And these songs, like I was a kid in the 80s, so these songs are all like,
right.
I remember Billy Ocean and I remember like, you know,
right.
all these songs. And I'm just thinking, how in the world did he afford the rights to all this stuff? Was one of my questions. But
with an independent, like kind of lower budget film.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah. how do you, that those songs now would cost the whole, it was like $1 million or something he made it for.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right.
I don't think that's what we're here to talk about, but I did love that he used all these kind of cheesy is not the right word. I hate when people call 80s music cheesy, but it also that ambient horror kind of score of like, that I associate so strongly in my mind with like 80s movies.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
a certain way. And so that weird mixture of like, this is all just giving me all these 80s vibes. But the main thing for me is just, it's not an original reaction, but I feel deeply unsettled the entire movie, both mm-hmm. times. And that's why mm-hmm. I waited 20 years to watch it again. I loved it the first time I saw it. I respected it. We were all obsessed at the time with, I mean, obviously Poison had come out, but we were all obsessed with you know, back in the old days before everything was on the internet. Everyone was trying to get the, you know, find the Karen Carpenter mm-hmm. story. So mm-hmm. So mythically, I knew that he had this other movie that was not allowed to be seen for weird rights reasons. And so, yeah, we were all just so happy to see Safe. And then it's one of those things where it's like, it's imagine getting excited to go see like, I don't know, Oppenheimer or Barbie or whatever. Like I was excited to see Safe, but then it just doesn't leave you with that same feeling of what, you know, you're just like, oh my God, this is so, and that was in, I probably saw it in 99, 2000.
Mm.
So yeah, pre this whole millennium. And then it was much more like the read was always, hey, this is very symbolic.
Yes.
And now I'm like, yeah, the scary part is it was scary enough being symbolic. Now when I'm watching it, I was like, this is literal. This is like this deep malaise that infects like all of society that you can't really even pinpoint what it is, except for that you just feel way worse than you did a few years ago. That resonates way too much. You know?
Yeah.
It's more about the I can't figure out what's wrong. And then I just love that. And he's very open about doing this deliberately, but it sets up all these conventions that you just keep thinking that there's going to be something that resolves what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it just never does it for you. And, mm-hmm. and I love that commitment. I admire it as an his artistic sensibilities to hang tight and not put a nice ending on it. But
mm-hmm.
at the same time, man, after 2 hours of that, yeah, about 2 hours.
Yeah.
I just really wanted a little resolution from a Julianne.
No. And he's like, fuck that.
Yeah, I know. So very deliberate. Very deliberately. Yeah. Fuck you.
Yeah.
He's like, that's not real life. And I hate movies like that. And every movie does it. And
exactly. Yeah. I know exactly the moment of the interview with Larry Gross that you're referencing when you say that.
So good. Yeah.
Yeah, such a good interview. I'm so glad you turned me on to it. And we'll link to it in the show notes also.
Yeah, it's great.
Where he's talking about kind of the vacuousness of that feel good moment and
yes.
that reconciliation that so many movies capitulate to. And you're so right that this one resists that.
Yeah.
And I do think that the kind of almost like timelessness of it and the interpretive flexibility is part of mm-hmm. what makes this so rich. Oh, like a, then yeah. and now. I mean,
do you mean like the tabula rasa aspect of like? I mean, you can kind of project a lot onto this. A lot.
You can. Yeah, it's a very plastic film in that way. I think, you know, yeah. like the references to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, mm-hmm. to chronic illness, what's formerly known as chronic fatigue syndrome.
I'd have to look up the date, but I don't think that was even a thing back then. I mean, people had vague illnesses that people still think they're crazy and just, oh, she's in that right. case. It's all in her head.
Yeah.
She does say very specifically, and he points that out in the interview, the chemicals did this to me.
You know? Yes, the chemicals.
It's like she's not, I mean, she's not well, but she's not hallucinating that something's clearly wrong with her.
No, and we see like Carol's nosebleeds.
Yeah.
We see her in a really shocking moment kind of seem to vomit blood from under and through her mask yeah. in the dry cleaner, which is like a totally harrowing overhead shot.
Yeah.
What really resonates with me watching it today is how much this reminds me of the kind of like shift from WebMD to maybe something more like TikTok and Instagram yeah. and the online wellness movement, I guess you yeah. could say, in a really, really yeah. loose
I think
way.
Instagram started it and TikTok has taken it hyperspeed.
You know? Well, it's sort of like what must have been on, I think, message boards and
sure.
real life face-to-face community situations like the one we see.
Flyers at health food stores.
Yeah. Like, are you allergic to the 20th century? Like, who isn't? But it's specifically that kind of depiction of experiences of vulnerability and yeah. perceived suffering and isolation that just feels as meaningful, if not more meaningful now for like a sort of over-connected kind of internet age mm-hmm. as it was in this sort of like late feminine mystique moment of 1987 that yeah. Haynes and Moore are depicting together.
So specifically, we're here to talk about a moment. I know yeah. I would love to talk about it for an hour, which is how I felt about the last one of these we did. Brevity is not my strong suit. So what moment are we here to focus on out of all these wonderfully composed moments in the film?
So the moment that struck me, and this was not easy to land on, there were like many, many sort of moments in the film,
yes.
images, transitions, shots, the wide shots, as you put it, that struck me. But the one that I want to talk about, it's about 40, 42 minutes into the film when Carol is attending her friend's baby shower, which is already a really wild looking scene because we see all these women in kind of Easter egg colored
yeah.
polyester dresses.
Yeah, iconic.
In this wall to wall carpeted living room, opening presents. There's something grotesque about it, even though it's broad daylight and seemingly a celebratory affair. Carol excuses herself and goes to the bathroom and she's kind of gazing at herself in the mirror. And this is a film that is so much about, obviously, Carol's experience of herself and her body.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And her health or lack thereof. But it does so through all this profound withholding. And it does it by distancing the camera from the subject, as you've talked about. It also does it from giving us periodic but not that revelatory voiceovers from Carol when she's addressing mm-hmm. like family or writing a letter or something. And rather than giving us a really intimate look at what she's thinking and feeling, we just sort of skim the surface.
Yeah. And also there's no backstory. Like, we don't get any information. Like,
no, we yeah, know that's she's from Texas and that's basically
yeah.
it.
And yeah. they have some money.
Right. Yeah. Just a little bit. Yeah. So this yeah. moment seems to offer a kind of access to Carol, but it just seems to, right? We follow her into the bathroom. We spend time with her. She's looking at herself. We don't know what she's thinking. It's sort of like the appearance of thinking, which is interesting. And Haynes understands that. And to understand that so profoundly in your second feature film, I think, is so, yeah. so special.
Yeah.
And instead of giving us something, the moment just takes something away. It takes away the image and specifically does it in this really weird, unexpected way where we get what almost looks like a wipe, which is
yeah.
her kind of sliding closed the bathroom door. And it looks like she's sliding the mirror closed. But whatever it is that she's doing, this like darkness just kind of obliterates mm-hmm. the image that we previously saw. And so what it is that we get is this like self-reckoning without that much in the way of resolution. And this to me feels like the hinge where from this point forward, Carol will really start to see herself as a sick person mm-hmm. and she'll start transforming her body and her face in accordance with that self-identification. And it also sort of predicts this image that happens at the end of the film when you know, famously is like,
I love you,
telling herself in almost like direct address to camera, I love you, in this really dingy mirror in her like scary hovel, wellness room.
Gotta love those happy endings.
Yeah. So it just is such a, like, I don't know, it's such a miraculous moment to give us this kind of bit of interiority or intimacy, but ultimately still through a screen, and to do that in this language of withholding and to just furiously defend the mystery of this movie. It's such a mysterious film, even though it's about this woman about whom the average audience member probably assumes they could think they know everything about her, right? Because she's, quote unquote, just a housewife or a homemaker, as she corrects herself. But really, the truth of what she's experiencing is unknown to us as much as it is to her.
Absolutely. 100% to steal your line. 100% agree. Yes, that's great. I just would love to hear you talk about that for hours. But
that's all the time we have.
Yeah. So catch us next time. I had the thought as you were talking, I was like, man, there are a lot of great mirror shots in cinema, and we should do a mirrors issue because it would be great.
Mm,
yeah. I was thinking like the apartment, you know, the little handheld cracked mirror in the apartment. I love, could watch that Contact movie over and over, that little part that I don't even know what to call what happens there. Looks like she's running towards the mirror, and then there's some word I'm sure for that. But that shot and then this shot. I like my mirrors.
If we do a mirrors issue, I will finally get to write about Sucker
Punch. The mirror has two faces. Oh, okay. I didn't know you wanted to write about Sucker Punch. You can write about that anytime you want.
There's a really incredible pitch sequence in Sucker
I've actually
Punch.
Never seen it.
Well.
Yeah. So, yeah, but no, I do like the other thing, and you kind of, I'm going to put way too fine a point on it, because it's alluding pretty directly to something you said about what those mirror scenes are. There are a lot of scenes like those in movies where characters give themselves pep talks, or they something usually happens. And I think that throughout this film, that's kind of the feeling, is like, okay, what's going to happen is the constant thing. I mean, I knew the second time because I've seen it before, but I was just like, what's going on? What's going to happen? And then, you know, when a character goes into a bathroom by themselves and the camera follows them in there and they're not going to the bathroom, there's going to be usually something that gives you some, like you said, insight into the character, something about how they, but it's, you get nothing out of it. And I mean, in terms of like story context, like in like the interiority, like you said, but I also like that you signify, which I hadn't really thought about, that moment signifies kind of the inversion point, whatever the phrase would be there, when she starts to transition to like seeing herself as a sick person. I'd never really thought of like that being the, it's almost like if you wanted to look at it that way, here's normal me. And then that black wipe is like, goodbye to all that. I'm now going to be this other person. Plus it just looks really cool too. There's also that aspect.
It looks super cool.
Like aesthetically, it's very pleasing to watch. Yeah.
It flags. It's a really exciting moment visually.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's not a lot of that in the movie. There's so much stasis in it. Any kind of movement is kind of, besides aerobics, is interesting.
As much as it's true, though, that nothing happens in that moment, here as elsewhere, Haynes is really demonstrating his profound understanding, like directly from melodrama and directly from Douglas Sirk, of what women do when they're alone. And when women alone in the bathroom, we do look in the mirror and have like contemplative, mysterious crisis moments, honestly, that are like unpredictable and irresolvable. And I think
that's fascinating.
It's incredible that he sort of like gives this little beat to that kind of moment. It's exactly the kind of like mundane horror that women, regular women, sort of like live through every day.
The last thing I wanted to say, just because it's an interesting concept. Do you know what the word like interoception means?
No.
Yeah. So interoception is a cool thing that I bring up with my clients a lot, because there are certain people that are acutely aware of everything that happens internally, both emotionally, but more specifically physically. So like if someone stubs their toe, they might notice for the next couple of days if they're very interoceptive, because they're focusing a lot of their attention on the internal sensations in their body. So an interoceptive person is just someone who does more about that, and the reason that you're doing it is you're trying to understand and make sense of all these things. So it's different than hypochondria, but there's a line there that you could certainly cross into, because if you're aware of every single little thing. So she seems to have a high amount of interoception where she's aware of all the stuff that's off, but we don't get to share in that. Whatever she, I get the sense that she is paying a lot of attention to stuff, but we are not getting that information. Yeah. And how interesting that is to make a whole movie out of somebody who doesn't give you any of that information, but can act it so clearly.
Shall we just go straight to CTAs?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to another installment of our new bite-sized monthly series in conversation with and sponsored by our friends at Gallery. And we'd actually love for you to join the conversation as well. For details about Gallery's live film discussions, sign up at join.gallery.com/BWDR.
Our theme music is composed by me.
You can do it Karina Longworth style. That's me.
Okay. I'll try one of those. Let's see if this works. Okay. Our theme music is composed by Chad Berman. That's me. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
That's me.
That's him.